Okay, good afternoon, everybody. We arrive at lecture number 20, otherwise known as network maps. So today we're going to look at cartometry in a completely different way. We're going to look at it from the perspective of topology, or movement throughout a network, throughout a set of connected graphs. So I've got a few terms to define, and then we'll give you some practical examples and show you why it's worth worrying about this kind of thing. What sort of applications we can deal with. Okay, one way of looking at a map like the online OpenStreetMap view of Isla Vista and surrounding area of Goleta is that we have really a set of places that are connected together by roads and transportation systems. So if you can walk out of your front door and get onto a sidewalk or a road and it connects to other sidewalks and roads, then you are part of a network. You can move around within that network and trace out a path. And usually when we're talking about networks, we talk about having an origin point. That's where you start your trip from. And a destination point, that's where you're going to end your trip. And as we've seen, that can be a series of those that we can put together to make a single trip. So we're still somewhat in the vein of navigation, as we've done in the last few lectures. So when we start thinking about networks and network maps, we always sort of fall back on this classic network diagram. The London Underground system was, since it was so many different train systems that were put together over a period of many years, it's become an extremely complicated diagram. So by the 1930s, when they were in search of a new map to show the network, the task fell to a guy whose training was in electrical circuitry design, and he just simply produced an electronic circuit map of the underground system in London. The lines are all color-coded in different colors. The stations are these dots, and if you know anything about London, there's the airport ray out there which connects to the underground system. This sort of stick representation is the River Thames. And this light blue stuff out here is the new Docklands Light Railway that's been put into place. It's an automated system, mostly above ground, although it does go under the river here to arrive at the Greenwich Meridian, right about here. But it's been extended out this way to link into the properties that are all being built for the 2012 Olympics that you're going to see next summer. So it's a really good example of a network map. Notice that in producing the map, what we've done is we've shortened the connections between individual locations because we simply say they're not relevant. You simply arrive at this station, you get off at that station. How you get there is not really relevant. We just want to show that there's a connection in place. And that, of course, the overall network has been distorted quite considerably. I mean, some of these outer places are a long way from London, and this inner district here is really not that big. Tourists are often surprised that the stations in the inner city of London here are often only a block or so apart from each other. But there are networks everywhere. A good example, the tram system in Melbourne, Australia. Last time I was there, they booked me into a hotel that was right on this main route here, and the tram started trundling by about 4 a.m. and they came by about every 10 minutes after that, so they were very noisy. So there are lots of different networks and network maps that correspond to them. Often they can be highly symbolic. So here is a network map of Hawaiian Air and its connections. So we have internal island links like to Kauai and Oahu, Molokai, Maui here. And then some links to the Big Island, but we've got two locations. But then we've got even shorter or not much longer links, and we're in Sydney, Australia, or Phoenix, Arizona. So these are often called radial networks because they have a single spoke and or hub, like this location on Oahu, here in Hawaii proper, and all of the connections that it makes to it. Another kind of network, and one that does feature prominently on topographic maps, is the power grid. And the power grid being the system that supplies us with our electrical power. We've seen a lot of this in the press recently with the power structure and the failure of the system on various occasions. Once you realize that the way the system is connected together, it's got a lot of vulnerabilities in it, We often have these catastrophic failures of the system these days simply because of a lack of connectivity or true network connectivity within these systems. If one node goes down, it can bring down whole sections of the network, as we've seen happen in a big power failure on the East Coast, another one here in, on the West Coast within the last year. So some of the terminology, what are the terms I'm going to be using? We're going to be talking largely about topology, because when we throw away the actual geographic locations and we make them symbolic, what we retain is simply the relations among the, in this case, the points and the node, the links. So those become more significant. We have two types of objects, a link or a route, and in the maps I've just been showing you, those can be represented as straight lines or sometimes as curved lines, but really they only are symbolic. Here we've got, say, one going over the other. We assume there's some kind of crossing there. Here we're just simply linking this to this, and we're simply showing that these don't overlap, although we do have some overlapping links like this internal connection to Mali. So those are links or routes. We also have places or nodes. Those are the destinations and origin points. Those are the nodes shown on this graph here, and they're either local or not, whatever they might happen to be. So we've really just got these two elements on which we're going to construct the networks, the links and the nodes. We can talk about topological distance, and topological distance can be just simply the number of steps that you have to take to get from A to B, the number of stations you pass, number of traffic lights between here and there, or it can be, you know, very long airline flights compressed to be equivalent lengths. So the lengths don't necessarily mean very much. And the distances are topological. Exactly what that means we'll see in just a minute. We can talk about something called a diameter. And diameter is the maximum length to get from where you currently are to the edge of the network. So to get from any point in the network to the edge of the network, we talk about this as a diameter. In New York City, they actually make a competition out of this. They see who can get on the subway. Well, it used to be with a token. You get on with a token and ride the furthest and take in the most stops and go the longest distance and still only pay one fare. So you try and figure out and calculate the way that you can stay on the network for as long as possible. So this idea of the longest connection between the two furthest most points is what I mean by the diameter of a network. We can talk about accessibility. Parts of a network are better served than other parts. If we go back to the map of London, let's say, obviously there's some pretty remote spots out here that you have to ride the entire length of the train to get to these remote locations towards the end of the lines. Other points, let's say like Piccadilly Circus down here, in the middle of the city might be served by multiple lines and are far more accessible or more connected within the network. And given accessibility, they can then talk about connectivity, and in fact what I'm going to do is define a connectivity index, an index that shows you how connected a network is. Okay, let's start again with some definitions. If we can take the entire world or any kind of geographic phenomenon, let's say it's a flight network or a road network or a rail network, and reduce it simply to nodes and links, the only question we really need to ask is, can we get there from here? So if we're at this station here, let's say the only place we can go is this one. We have to traverse that node or that link to be able to get from A to B. We call this a planar network graph because it's constrained to just sit in two dimensions. So we can't say go over here and hop over these two links. We'd be breaking them. You can imagine this is the street network where everything has to go on the level of the streets, and we can't have bridges or tunnels as part of this network. So we call this a network planar graph. Let's see, okay. Now we can talk about a network planar graph in which every possible link is connected to every other link. So here we see that each node gets connected to all its adjacent nodes, and it means that we can get to every other node by going through different nodes. Okay, so we call this a fully connected planar graph because here we've constrained it to be in the single plane, but we've allowed you to go from any node to any other node traversing across the network. The only question is how many steps does it take to get from A to B? Or we can have a fully connected non-planar graph. Okay, so now we've drawn every link between every one of the nodes, so I can now get from any node to any other node in just one trip, one leg, or one link. Okay, but notice that that brings into case all sorts of contradictions. For example, to get across here, I have to cross over four different other links. And yes, you know, a road can go over another road on a bridge, or it could go over a tunnel, or a train crossing can cross over a road. But eventually you run out of sort of dimensions in how to be able to support this. Okay, we have lots of examples of non-planar graphs within our transportation network. Here we've connected highway interchange, so you can pretty much get from anywhere to anywhere else. You might call this a spaghetti junction. But we can leave pretty much any one lane and connect with any other lane. So we've got multiple highways and minor roads crossing at different angles, and we've put a full set of connections in here so that we can indeed make any one of these links between one road and the next. And it's definitely non-planar, and the price we have to pay there is we have to go over bridges or overpasses to be able to make the connections. Okay, let's do a quick review of some graph theory to go along with this. Here I'm going to let n simply be the number of nodes. So that's just how many dots there are on the map. On this one I had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's 7 nodes. Okay, so we can talk about planar and non-planar graphs. I did. We can talk about symmetric or non-symmetric links. So we can say a link is only good for one direction but not for the other direction. So you can imagine that if we had a transportation system, we had roadways on the surface, we could have one-way streets where the traffic could only legally go in one direction. Now that would be a non-symmetric link, because we can go from A to B, but we can't go back from B to A. And that's very often the case. Okay. If we have a symmetric planar graph, that means we're constrained to the plane, and we allow every link to be two-directional, then we can talk about the maximum number of connections that are possible within that network. So if we just take the number of nodes, subtract 2, and multiply the answer by 3, that's the maximum number of connections that are possible within that network. Just comes out of straightforward graph theory out of mathematics. If we have a symmetric non-planar connection, okay, so now we're going to have more connections, because this is the case where we added those blue lines and added all the connections that were possible. Then we have n times n minus 1 over 2 possible links within the network. Okay. If we have a non-symmetric, non-planar, okay, so this means that we've got directed streets or links within the network, and we're not constrained to a flat surface, then the maximum number of connections is simply n times n minus 1. And if we have a non-symmetric planar, okay, so we're allowing one-way streets, but we're constraining everything to be without any bridges or tunnels, then the maximum number of connections is 6 times the number of nodes minus 2. Okay, so this won't ever be on a test or anything like that unless I'm giving you these formulae. Just take them at faith right now. Let's explore a couple of them. So let's look at some graph measures. The numbers here being shown are the diameters. So if I start at this point here, how many links does it take to get to the furthest most point on the network? Well, that's this one, and you have to go 1, 2, 3 links to get to here. So its diameter is 2. You notice that if we're here, we're slightly more accessible. To get to the most remote point, which is either that one or that one, we only traverse 2 links. So we say that these have lower individual diameters at their nodes. And if we search this to see what the maximum diameter for the whole graph is, that's what we call the diameter of the entire graph. So its diameter is 3. Here's the 7 nodes. I counted them off before. I haven't changed it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And here we have 7 links. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The maximum possible number of links for this situation, which is a symmetric planar graph, then, is 3 times n minus 2, which is 15. So the maximum possible number of links on this graph is going to be 15. And we can talk about something called a connectivity index, and that's the actual number of links versus the possible number of links. So this is, we convert it to a percentage. So the actual number of links is 7, the maximum possible is 15. So we can say that this has a connectivity index of 47%, or it's about half fully connected. And we can talk about the relative amount of connectivity associated with any given network. So think about these new measures now, and start thinking about actual network systems. Here is the Los Angeles Metrorail network system. Let's say we have let's say we start out here, out towards the northwest of the LA Basin. You'll see that we really only got one network that extends out in that direction. We're very disconnected. There's very little connectivity within the system. The only real points of high degrees of connection are here in the center of the system, or here around the central parts. So you might say that the diameter of this graph is very high, because there are a lot of nodes we need to traverse to go from one extreme to the other, say one end of the city to the other, and that the actual number, the index, if we were to calculate it, this index, the connectivity index of the actual versus the possible, is very low, because there are a large number of possible connections that could be put into place, but only a few of those have actually been made. Okay, here's another network. Networks don't have to be constrained to things truly geographic. This is a piece of software called NetViz, which you can hook into on Facebook. And what this does is it takes all of your Facebook friends and their friends and their friends and their friends and so on, and builds a network link. The size of this is how many people link in at a particular point. And then the links are friends. So here's a friend of a friend of a friend. And at least three links within there. So you can literally put your social network onto a network, and it has these same properties. And we can talk about, you know, what's the diameter of your social network? How connected is your social network? How accessible are you to your social network? And you can see that, as you might sort of suspect, similar people kind of pile up together and make little groups with overlapping interests. So we get sort of mini networks forming within a larger network, and these associate with other groups, usually through a few individuals who act as sort of high points of accessibility. Somebody can cross over between two worlds. You know, they're on a sports team and a chess club, let's say. So they link two groups of people together. So don't think of networks as constrained to simply something that you can put on a transportation map. Networks are pretty much everywhere when you start looking for them. Now, we looked at the example of London earlier on, and let's do something unique. This is a piece, actually from a piece of software that came out a couple of years ago, that allows you to take the original map, which is here, to then transform it onto its actual geometry on the landscape, so actually go to the places where the stations really are, and then transform those back to the network map. Okay, so the grid behind it was a perfectly square regular grid back on the real world, but then when it gets distorted into the map, the way the network's been portrayed, you can see all the distortions that are inherent within this network map. So you see that all the areas within the center of the city here have become very much larger squares than the ones on the outside. So we've essentially magnified the middle of the city, where we've got more stations and more people and so on. And we've got quite a considerable amount of distortion. I mean, look at some of the distortion here in some of these cells. And that as we go out into the suburbs, we're kind of more compressed. We get smaller and smaller squares. So I would say, imagine that there was such a thing as a uniform social network that we could put on that diagram. You might say, how would its space be distorted in any one particular setting? You know, what effect does, say, all you being at UCSB have on distorting that pattern and pulling it out of its regular geometric shape? Okay, now let's move on to consider the case of directed graphs. You can do unusual things with directed graphs. So let's say we are now here. Okay, if we're here, the only place we can go is here. Okay, So we don't have any options. If we want to be into the network, we have to go through an initial entry point or a portal or a friend or whatever it might happen to be. So if you're, you know, if you fly a lot out of Santa Barbara Airport, you pretty much can't get anywhere without going to LAX first or to SFO or to Denver or one of these connection points. And then occasionally we've got, let's say, this node out here. Since these two are directed nodes, are directed links, if we're over here or over here, it's going to be impossible to reach this point here. So you literally can't get there from here on this kind of a network. So you can't traverse the network sufficiently. Parts of it become isolated. You might say their connectivity or their accessibility breaks. It becomes disconnected from the main graph. Now that happens all over the place. The most commonly used directed network graph in cartography is the street map. This is how Google Maps works. It's how all of the online mapping services work. If you want to call up directions to drive around the streets, underlying it somewhere is something like this. So we've got every single arc labeled, and it's directed. We know that we can only go this way around this intersection pattern here. Here's a traffic circle. We can only go around in one direction, for example. So anytime we've got these connected graphs, we can only move in the direction of travel that's shown. That's not always the case, but often we do this because we separate individual lines of travel, individual lanes on a highway, and make them part of the network as well. So we can only drive on the right side of the road and so on. Okay, so far we've been talking about connected graphs, but not all connected graphs, not all networks are connected graphs. Some of them are so-called directed graphs. In other words, they're really distribution networks. They start from a large number of points and they converge on one or two. And a good example would be an ordered network like a stream system, or a tree system as it's often called. So imagine that this is, let's say, a high order stream. This is the outlet to the ocean. Every time we go up to another order stream, we get up closer and closer to the watershed boundaries itself, to the higher elevations, and we end up with a tree graph. Now these tree graphs are everywhere. You just pick up a leaf that's fallen off a tree and look at it. You can see a tree graph in the capillary network in the leaf, because it's feeding nutrients exchange gases between the leaf and the stem. It's another distribution network. So lots of things have distribution networks like this. Your internet connection to your house, although wireless comes into play and distorts this a little bit. The power distribution grid that brings the power to your house. Something like a sewage network where you flush a toilet here and you pretty much hope that it all goes in one direction away from you somewhere else. So there are lots of tree types of networks. Our lungs are a good example of a tree network. They deal with exchanging gas and so on with the blood. So they do it through a bronchial network. Now, very often we talk about hierarchical systems to tree networks. So we're always looking to impose some degree of order on tree networks. And one of the common systems for imposing hierarchy is called the Strehler stream order, named by Arthur Strehler, a famous geomorphologist who was one of the first quantitative geomorphologists, actually lived here in Santa Barbara after his retirement from Columbia University. And he came up with this ordering system that simply says if you start each network branch from the initial point, let's say where the spring comes out of the earth, and we call those ones in our hierarchical network, anytime two streams of the same order meet, then you can increase the order by one. So when two ones meet here, they form a two. When two twos meet here, they form a three. When two threes meet here, they form a four, and so on. So by the time we get to 12, 13, 14, we've reached some of the most complicated river systems in the world, you know, the Amazon and so on. Now we can also talk about something called a bifurcation ratio, and that's simply how many links at one order they're going to be with respect to links at the next order. So let's say we're going to compare level one, the number of level one links in a network, in a tree network, to the number of level two links. If they're about the same, then we're not getting much branching taking place. If they're double, then each one divides into two. But if they're much larger than two, then we have the kind of pattern that branches out very quickly. One way to think about bifurcation ratios is that they're very common in real trees. So when you see a tree in the landscape, it's got the main stem, the main trunk as it goes up, and then it usually splits and goes into branches and sub-branches and so on. You take something like a fig tree, like the ones out here outside on the campus, they go up and then they suddenly branch out with, you know, 13 or 15 different points all going out from the same location. And then those tend to branch off with fewer and fewer branches as they get up into the tree. Not all trees are like that. A lot of deciduous trees go to two or three branches, and then those go to two or three branches, and so on. So a bifurcation ratio is simply how much split there is at any given level in the hierarchy of the network. All right, let's move on here. So if we can think about networks hierarchically, it's very useful cartographically because we can apply what's called pruning. So just as you go to a real tree and prune off all the little branches to try and keep it in shape, in a network, when we want to remove the lowest level of significance, we can just simply take that level of the hierarchy out, and we can prune it out, and then put in the next level of connectivity. So here we've got a map of the same area I showed you at the beginning. All the minor streets have now disappeared. All the internal streets within IV, for example, have disappeared completely, and only the topologically significant connections have been put into place here to show you the overall pattern of how to move around on the UCSB campus. I love how the mountains have simply become this block of blue pictures at the top of the screen there. Okay, now there's many ways that we can order a stream, a hierarchical network. I showed you the Strehler order, in which we simply start at the outside with everything labeled a 1, and we only increase the order when two values with the same value come together. So 2 1s make a 2, 2 2s make a 3, and so on within this network. Another way to do it is the so-called Shreve system, where here a 1 and a 1 make a 2, and a 2 and a 2 make a 4. So we're sort of accumulating the absolute total value of the amount of material, that's called the amount of water, you can think of it, that's coming down the stream. So our total amount of 10 is literally the number of branches upstream that we would have from this particular point. So another way, and probably more useful if we're monitoring floods or major events taking place through a network. Now, many of the packages that do work in GIS that support cartography allow us to calculate stream order. So we can go out and grab data, like this is a set of data from the National Streams Database from the U.S. Geological Survey. We can simply bring this in and put the orthophoto image behind it. Notice they don't match up perfectly here. And then we've used the software to calculate what the Strehler order of each of the streams is. The yellow areas are each individual drainage basin within this system. So this actually can be used in the real world. I mean, it does have a context. I'm not just giving you a bunch of baloney here. Now, it turns out that putting streams on digital elevation models and on digital maps of the world is an extremely important thing to do. So here in the United States, we have the National Streams Hydrographic Database, which is hierarchical. It has code numbers on every line, on every stream segment that tell you how it integrates up with all the other levels within the hierarchy of drainage basins. So we can very quickly put that together. This is from the Shuttle Radar Topographic Mapping Mission. I believe that was mentioned when you heard about mapping topography. Even though that was released at 90 meters for the whole world, 30 meters for the United States, it's actually available at 30 meters from the entire world. If you talk to them nicely, they'll release the data. But one of the things that has been done is the entire database has been fed through an automatic stream flow generator that allows each one of the stream segments to be labeled and then tagged, and then some modeling to be conducted that would, say, predict the amount of flooding or the amount of water that would come down each of those streams given different rainfall events. So here we see Panama. Here's the equivalent of a lake area with these little stream segments brought in. In the blue are all the lake bodies here, even the little tiny ones. In the green are the areas surrounding them, which can be extracted automatically by the software from the digital elevation model, so we can actually grow and build the network automatically just by analyzing the geometry and the topology. Here's our National Hydrographic Database. I've zoomed in on the local area so you can see what the large-scale numbers for each of the drainage systems are here. Now, if you think about our particular geometry of where we are right now, we actually have quite a weird set of circumstances for hydrology, because we have St. Inez Mountains only 8 to 10 miles in from the coastline where we are right now. Sometimes they get a little closer. So the actual watersheds are not going to be very long this way, in the north-south direction. Each individual stream is going to be constrained by the channel in which it comes out of the mountains. You can pretty much see them as you look up at the hills, where each one of those stream segments is going to come down, and then eventually it's going to find its way out into the ocean, pretty much in a dead straight line. If we jump across the mountains into the St. Inez Valley, we've got the exact opposite. We've got an east-west flowing drainage system rather than north-south flowing drainage system. And there the rivers, or the main river, the St. Inez River, drains out towards Vandenberg Air Force Base and out into the ocean up further on up here. So what this database allows you to do is to look at the hierarchy of the drainage systems and analyze them accordingly and pull out what level of detail, the level of detail in which you're interested. But it also divides up the whole region into some very important watersheds, some big partitioned watersheds. If you want to move water from one to the next, then you've got quite a serious problem ahead of you. Although we do indeed move water from Lake Kachuma, which is Santa Barbara's water supply, through a tunnel, through the mountains, up a tunnel road, down into the Goleta Water District. So you can move water between these watershed systems. So they can take a naturally occurring network and disrupt it, change it around. All of California is really just a story of how we've taken these natural watershed boundaries and moved water, sometimes on a massive scale, from one end of the state to the other. If we've got a network like this, let's say a stream network, this is a dendritic stream network, we can do things like this, which is to calculate a distance transform on the network. So let's say that your application involves finding, archaeological settlements, let's say, and since they didn't have, let's say they were Maya settlements and they didn't have draft animals or the wheel, you had to walk to your water supply, and you didn't want it to be too far away, otherwise you were going to die of thirst. So you could argue that that these white areas, which are the most remote areas from the water supply, are the least likely to be populated, and the areas closer to the water are more likely to be populated. And you could argue the same thing goes for vegetation, animals, and humans. Okay, we can think about networks and how entire networks connect together. Okay, so let's say, let's take an exact, precise example. I've just been trying to make an airline reservation for next spring to go to Istanbul. Okay, and ran all the numbers to try and figure it out, and there's no way I can leave and make a connection to Turkish Airlines from Santa Barbara. Okay, so I have to take the Santa Barbara Airbus to get to LAX before I can connect with the airline that connects to Turkish Airlines. Okay, so I have to choose a different mode of transportation because there's no connection between these two network systems. We've got some glorious examples of this happening right now. If we think about the airlines, we've just had United Airlines and Continental attempting to merge with each other. Previously, two separate and competing airlines. So they were designing their networks to be mutually exclusive, to not collaborate with each other, so they could corner the market on travel in different locations. All of a sudden, you need to flip that network around and form it back into a connected network. Things like LAX, their two terminals are opposite ends of the airport, so they're having to deal with all sorts of problems like that. In the airlines, generally speaking, the large airlines generally fly all over the country, but they still have their hubs where the airline's traditionally associated with. For United Airlines is Chicago and LAX, for example. the smaller distributor airlines are the ones that have really won out. And so it's called commuter airlines because they just make all the connections between the other airlines. So if you leave from Santa Barbara and you want to connect on, say, a Continental or American Airlines or United flight, you've probably only got one contractor you can fly with, in this case, perhaps SkyWest. And they only have a few locations that they fly to from Santa Barbara. They have their own hubs. So you might think about not just a single network and its connectivity and links, but how do multiple networks come together? You might say the sort of classic transportation problem for a city is, how do I make all the transportation networks work together? So if I arrive on a train and I step off the train, there should be a bus waiting for me that takes me to exactly where I want to go without a connection. How do we ensure that that level of connectivity happens within networks? We don't seem particularly good at it in the United States. There's what's often called multimodal transportation. You pretty much can't exist in Southern California without a car. But it's not the case in much of the rest of the world, where the transportation networks are highly synchronized, where you literally can depend upon a tram pulling up just as a bus is about to leave, so you can make a transfer very quickly. Okay, if we have network systems, we can sort of unencode them to produce directions. So this is MapQuest, but any of the map services will do it. We can take a passage from A to B, from origin to destination, and derive each one of the network connections that we're going to have to go through to get from A to B. And so we can do exactly what we did in Dead Reckoning, divide a trip into a series of legs, and each leg is a distance or sometimes a duration when you're driving. Then it has a series of instructions associated with it, usually what exit you want to take, what new highway we want to get on, do you want to turn left, turn right, go straight ahead, whatever it might be. Okay, here's a little demonstration of how those work. So you might say, if I'm going to give directions like that, obviously I don't want to take the person off on a random journey from A to B. I'd like it to be the shortest path from A to B. Okay, so if I define short as meaning the shortest travel distance, then I can use something called Dijkstra's algorithm. And this is famous and well known within the sort of transportation planning world. In fact, there are hundreds of papers written on this every year on how to improve it and make it run better and so on. What are we trying to do? Well, here's my origin point, this yellow pointer here. And here's my destination, I think it's this one up here. What the algorithm does is it keeps computing local solutions to the problem. So first it looks at one link connections to the point of origin, finds out where those are, then it starts looking at the second link connections, and as you can see, it kind of makes a tree, one of these tree branching systems. All the time while it's following an individual tree, so there's one branch of the tree going off this way, one here way, we can continue to track how long we've been in the network, what distance traveled is, how many nodes we passed, how many links we passed, and pretty soon we can see that some paths, like this one here, are really not particularly favorable. They're not winning out in the race to the end. One network path, I believe it's this one here, is going to find its way to the destination first, and therefore it's going to be the most efficient way to get from A to B, I think. That one's looking like it, but in fact this one actually makes it. So that's the path that's chosen through your Google Maps directions to give you the shortest path between A and B. Notice that even a slight change to the rules is going to change how the decision is made. So if instead of, say, the length of each path, I assign, say, a driving time on that path at 30 miles per hour, it's going to change the pattern and the distribution, because the length and the distance are not directly, or the time and the distance are not directly interchangeable. I might want to minimize the number of left turns I have to make, or I'd like to stay on one road as long as possible, or I'd like to simply get onto the freeway in the shortest possible route and then stay on the freeway as long as possible before I get off of it. So there are other criteria that I can apply to this solution. If you can come up with a new solution to the Dijkstra's algorithm, you can make yourself a fortune and an academic name in the field of transportation geography. Okay, here's another problem that's often solved in transportation geography. What if I had to visit every single populated place in the United States in sequence, or it can be any sequence, but I have to visit them all? How do I do that and travel the minimum total amount of distance? Well, it's easy. You just follow this map, right? And what exactly happens here, I'm not quite sure. You might have to invest in a small boat or something for that leg, or some of these legs here, or maybe a small plane. But as you can see, it's got an individual network, in most cases, for every single state. So it's doing states within the order. Now, you might think this is kind of irrelevant, but this is how Amazon gets you your package within 3 days. And this is how FedEx works. This is how all the delivery services are able to very efficiently ship and move things around the country when you combine this kind of local delivery service route problem with the airline hub and spoke distribution network. It can work. In the early days of FedEx, for example, they had this major plant, I think it was in either Phoenix or Atlanta. I think it was Atlanta. And pretty much wherever you sent the parcel from on the East Coast, it went straight to Atlanta first. You know, if it was going between neighborhoods in New York City, it would go to Atlanta first, be sorted, and then go back to its destination, simply because that's how their system works most effectively. Another important concept in cartography and mapping that comes out of this idea of networks is the idea of an isochrone. We've learned about iso lines, like contour lines. Isochrone, you know, chronos is time. So here we've got equal times, or we've got contours drawn at equal amounts of time from any location. So this is actually the scene of the huge earthquake and tsunami from several years back now, the Boxing Day earthquake in Indonesia, that sent this huge tsunami out across the Indian Ocean, much less so across the South China Sea. But here we have 1 hour isochrones for the arrival of the tsunami. And you can see that even, you know, there was massive amounts of damage here in Africa and the Horn of Africa from this tsunami. Even though they're many thousands of miles away from the source, they're still getting the impact. It's still detectable 10, 11, 12, 13 hours later. We can still see this tsunami making its path around the entire planet. Now, here's isochrones in terms of a major event and a real pulse, like a tsunami. But isochrones are here all the time. Well, they're with us all the time. So let's say I rigged every one of you up with a GPS receiver, and we all left this lecture hall at exactly the same time when I finished my lecture, and we all head off across campus to do whatever it is we're going to do next, go and get some lunch, go and meet a friend, go back to your dorm room, whatever it might happen to be. Each of you then traces off one of these isochrones. So if I had the receivers recording you at 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, I could build a map of distance away from where we are right now, where we're all sitting right now. You'd all be acting as geosensors to create my map of the isochrones of the campus. And those kinds of isochrones are actually very valuable. In the advanced GIS class, one that we often calculate is the response time for the emergency services, the fire trucks and the police and the ambulance services to the campus. If you're, you know, if they're located a little bit off campus or over there by the stadium, how long is it going to take them to get here if I have a heart attack? Or say, over to the dorms if there's a medical emergency. Those are very important lengths of time to know. And we can calculate them in advance by knowing a network and then by using simulation to calculate the isochrones associated with the pattern. Here's another interesting pattern that we see often in sort of spatial analysis and economic geography. Here we've got a set of points on the landscape. These happen to be fairly regularly distributed. And what we've done here is construct a set of regions that are purely a function of the points' relationships to each other. So, for example, this dividing line here is a dividing line between all distances reachable from this point and this point. So it's equidistant. Every point along here is equidistant from those two points. And then when we get to this one, this line comes into play. So that now we've got competition between these two. And these form polygons on the landscape. They're called Voronoi polygons. A Voronoi, the collection of them together is called a Voronoi diagram. And these can be very useful. If we're a business, let's say, we're a Starbucks, and we have some sense of where our store locations are, and we have some sense of where our customers are, how do we partition up, or how do we optimally place the locations of the Starbucks to win as many customers as possible? Because this area is the number of customers that we're going to attract. Well, this is how you end up with, you know, 5 Starbucks on State Street in Santa Barbara, because they've got a dense market and they're trying to capture it. Here's a set of Voronoi cells calculated for world population, such that each cell has equal amounts of population. I don't remember there being too many people down here, but let's say they're counting people in aircraft flying around the world at the same time and averaging them out. And you can see where the centers of concentration of population are here in sub-Saharan Africa, in India, in Europe, here in North America, and throughout Asia. So here's my lecture on network maps. A little early. We've set up a set of technology, and the terminology is borrowed directly from mathematics. So the terms I'm using are topology, topological connections, topological networks, planar graphs, non-planar graphs, directed graphs, nodes, and links. And we've noted that just by counting nodes and links and the number of nodes and links that we expect on a network, given its properties, like whether or not it's symmetric or not, allow simple measures. So we've talked about diameter and connectivity indexes that are absolute indexes of accessibility. So we can actually say compare the accessibility of London's underground system to Washington DC's metro system and say, well, this one is more connected than that, has more links, or it has more of the available links are actually in place. We've looked at tree networks, sort of a special case of networks, because they're distribution networks, and we've looked at things like hierarchical orders, like Strela numbering and measures associated with them, and things like the branching ratio, the degree to which a network bifurcates as it spreads out. And we've seen that we can devise algorithms that can compute the shortest path. By far the best known of these is the Dijkstra algorithm, and that's the one that's actually running. When I turn my TomTom on and I put in my it knows where I am, and I type in my destination, and it says, computing from the 17 million routes available, blah, 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 blah. And there's 2 or 3 minutes later, bang, it's found the correct route. It's actually applied the Dijkstra algorithm to all the roads in California and come up with the route that I have to drive to get from here to Sacramento. And then lastly, we met this concept of the isochrone, or lines joining points associated with equal times. And those can be extremely informative and useful maps. Okay, see you all again on Wednesday.